This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 2017 has not been a good year for the Mecklenburg County Health Department. In February, it was revealed that the department failed to notify about 200 women who had questionable pap smear results. Ultimately, that led to the resignation of Health Director Dr. Marcus Plesha, an internal review of department operations, as well as studies conducted by two different outside consultants. The reports recommend sweeping changes in management. County Manager Dina DiIorio also warned members of County Commission that enacting necessary changes might take as long as a year. The Charlotte Observer reported that some officials fear it might take longer and cost taxpayers millions of dollars. So here to talk about the ongoing revelations of mismanagement and substandard care, consultant recommendations, the timetable, and the costs of implementing changes is County Manager Dina DiIorio. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Back.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. We're also joined by WFAE health reporter Alexandra Olgan, who I'm going to call Alex.
Sounds good.
Thank
I like
you.
It.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
And as we go through this, you may have some questions or comments of your own. You can reach us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, where we are broadcasting this morning on Facebook Live, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Before we talk about the health department, let's talk about soccer for just a second, because in the newspaper this morning, there was, and I think on WFAE, there was a report that the Major League Soccer officials are coming to town next week to have discussions with city council and county officials, and they were going to be involved in a private meeting. People got very upset with the private meeting idea, and I'm told that you canceled that private meeting. Is that correct?
So we were told by the local soccer entity, MLS for CLT, that MLS was not interested in having public meetings. And so what we tried to do is we tried to schedule private meetings, whether it be one private meeting with four members or in small groups, to have them give them an opportunity to talk to the MLS officials. But our board decided the majority wanted to have a public meeting. And if that was not going to suit MLS, then, in fact, we went ahead and canceled the meeting.
And by law, if I'm right about this, if four county commissioners or five city council members attend a meeting, it has to be public, right?
Five county commissioners.
Okay. So that would have to be public.
Correct.
Are five county commissioners attending this?
Well, we're not having it.
Okay.
So,
would they have attended this?
If we had had the meeting, there would have been more than five, and it would have had to have been a public meeting,
okay.
Yes.
At some point, when you're negotiating with any entity, whether it's Major League Soccer or somebody else, you have to have some kind of private meeting, because you don't want those negotiations out in public. That's not how it works, is it?
There are times when we go into closed session to talk about certain deal points. In fact, this would not be one of those occasions. It was really more of a meet and greet kind of situation. But we didn't feel, or MLS did not feel, MLS for CLT did not feel it was substantive enough to have an open meeting coming this Tuesday. Now, that doesn't preclude them from coming back another time and having
right.
a public meeting with our board.
So they're coming.
They are coming.
They're doing site they're just looking at the site? Is that what they're doing?
They're going to be coming to look at the site. They're going to be having a rally in First Ward Park at 5 mm-hmm. o'clock, and they'll be also doing some other site visits out in the other parts of the county.
But nobody is officially meeting with them?
Nobody from the county commission is officially meeting with them.
Anybody
at this time.
From the county commission unofficially meeting with them?
Nobody from the county commission unofficially meeting with
anybody
them.
Anybody from the county office unofficially or
I will
officially
be.
Meeting.
I will see them when they are here on Tuesday.
Okay. Let's move on to the Mecklenburg County Health Department. Workers in the health department knew about the problems there last year, 2015. That's 2 years ago. They knew about it. And it came to light at the beginning of last year. I think you found out, and Dr. Marcus Plesha, then the health director, found out on January 4th, 2016?
2017.
Okay. Why was he particularly, but why were you also out of the loop?
Well, I mean, that was really one of the problems, is that there were problems that were discovered and those issues were not elevated up to management in the health department or to me. And that was one of the things that we discovered that needed to be fixed, is that, you know, there was not enough accountability in terms of how information is shared across the department. And so we had a problem that went unreported mm-hmm. For an extended period of time.
And when you found out about this, things have developed since then. I don't want to say they trickled out, but we found out more and more and more about the problems as time has gone on. When you first heard about this, what was your reaction?
Well, I mean, my first reaction was that we needed to make sure that we understood the scope of the problem and we identified the women who were impacted. That mm-hmm. was our primary priority was to really find these women, make sure they had gotten the care that they needed. That was my priority.
They've all been found?
All 185 women. There have been reports that there were close to 300, and that is not the case. It was 185 women.
185 women, and the fact that they had abnormal pap smears, which meant that left them open to the possibility of something serious medically. Was that the case with any of them?
There were some that needed follow-up colposcopies, which is a procedure to take out, remove some material that could be dangerous in the future. And then there were others that needed to make sure that they just got follow-up tests in the following year.
And you found out about this on January the 4th. I'm not exactly certain when the county commission was informed, but they were informed shortly thereafter. And then on February 21st, this was released to the public. Why the delay?
The delay was because we were really focused on trying to find the women that were impacted, 185 women. So if we had gone out initially and said that we had this problem and we didn't know the scope of the problem, we really were concerned that a lot of women who had come into the health department would feel like they were impacted and we would create a public health scare. So really focused on understanding the scope of the problem, identifying the women that needed to be contacted and contacting them from the county as opposed to them hearing about it in the media.
Since that initial problem was discovered, what else have we discovered about the health department?
Well, operation? We've discovered a lot of things. I mean, the primary theme that has come out of these consultant reports, one, is that our technology needs to be improved. Our electronic medical record, we believe, is insufficient to do what we needed to do. The delivery of care in the clinics needs to be improved dramatically. We have a lot of inefficiencies in the clinic, and the number of patients that we see is well below industry standard. We don't have a clear way to sort of move people through the clinic efficiently. We have some concerns about maintaining privacy of information around patients. So there's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done.
How much of this took place because of or under the leadership of Dr. Plesha, and how much of it preceded him?
I think that when we took the health department back from Carolina's healthcare system in 2013, a lot of these problems already existed. Mm-hmm. I think that had we been proactive and had the people in charge in 2013 been proactive in really trying to understand what we inherited, we could have probably fixed the problems much quicker. But the folks that were really in charge of bringing that back and working on that transition, I don't think did enough due diligence about what we were bringing back and doing that kind of work.
And this also precedes you as county manager.
It does precede me as county manager.
Fred Clayson Kelly was on this program last week. He's the reporter from the Charlotte Observer who has been covering this since the very beginning, and he says that Julie Seacrest, an agency nurse, compiled a report for you, I think, and the commission in February after reviewing records, and she wrote, "The problem is much worse than I was told, and it includes poor-performing employees, bad supervision, bad data management, bad clinical procedures, bad initial assessment of problems, bad triage, and incomplete corrective actions. Patient care has been poor at best, and at worst, patients' health and safety has been at risk." Did the consult you had two consultants also compiling reports? Does that dovetail with what they told you, or is this worse?
I think it reflects what the consultants told us about how care is being provided in the clinics. I would say that really reflects what we found out from our consultants.
Why did we need two outside consultants to tell us what's wrong?
So we had one consultant that looked specifically at the clinics. We got somebody who was a specialty, specializes in clinical operations because we knew that was something that needed to be looked at. And the other consultant, Praxis Partners for Health, really was helping us understand what the organizational structure should look like in the health department, and they made some recommendations about that as well. The other thing that Praxis Partners brings to the table is their huge depth in public health. Navigant, who understands clinical operations, does not bring an expertise in public health. We wanted to make sure that the recommendations that they brought forward were appropriate for a public health setting, and that's what Praxis Partners helps us do.
Alex Olgan is relatively new to town. She's been here for about 3 weeks, but she's dived into this as our health reporter, and you were at the recent county commission meeting at which these consultant recommendations were presented. How would you describe the reaction to the presentation?
Well, to follow up on what Manager DiIorio said, Vilma Leek, Commissioner Leek, said that the problems are not new. They've been going on for a while. Mm-hmm. And actually, let's hear from that commissioner.
The Charlotte-Mecklenburg Health Department has been a problem over the years in Mecklenburg County. So it did not just happen. It happened to come public when the amount of work was not done to take care of residents in District 2 and 3 that related to the women in that report. All of this has been going on, so our manager inherited a major problem that we are now trying to assess and to do something about it.
That's Vilma Leek, who represents District 2, and she said that this has been a problem for years. So why are we just now doing something about it?
Well, I think that we knew that we had some issues that we were trying to work through, I think that this incident really precipitated us taking a closer
look
at what was
happening. Did Dr. Plesha understand that there were issues?
I think he tried to understand that there were issues. I think he did.
But nothing happened.
I think that there were opportunities for us to do more quickly. Okay. I would definitely say that.
And one thing that the navigant, the consultant, brought up was that there were too few managers for the number of employees. And one of the things that was recommended was that there are more managers to supervise people so they can have a closer pulse on what's going on in the department. And so it seems to me that that's one of the things you're looking at.
Perhaps they could borrow some from the school system. There seems to be a lot of managers in the school system right now.
Well, to Alex's point, though, they did talk about span of control and that there were only two assistant health directors, that each of them were managing about 400 people. And when you have that many people and programs reporting to you, it is really hard to get the kind of information that you need.
You also brought along a piece of a clip of Trevor Fuller, who's the county commissioner at large.
Yeah, and he asked Praxis Partners for Health, which was the consulting firm that looked at more of the structural changes. You know, would these change if we implement these changes, or if the county implements these changes, would that have prevented the problem? And let's hear from
would
him.
Would any of these recommendations have prevented, if they had been followed, would they have prevented the problems that we've been having with the health department in the last couple of months?
There are were issues with span of control. So, and that would be true for the clinical area as well as for the rest of the organization. That was one of the things we identified. The leadership team was very small. They have a lot of direct reports to them, to the leadership team level. The executive team was very small. So it's a question of chicken or egg, I think, in that. Did span of control contribute to the problem? Yes. Did it cause it? Probably not. But it is a factor that going forward that can be changed to improve accountability and supervision.
And that's Rosemary Summers, a consultant from Praxis. One key finding, we only have about a minute left in this segment, is that the care, getting care for patients, by patients, is not easy. It is not a straightforward process. What is the process? What has been the process?
Well, one thing that the consultant mentioned was it could take up to 50 minutes to get registered, just to finish the registration process in some of these clinics, and that it was confusing and people have to call different numbers and possibly go to different locations. And one thing the consultant recommended was just to centralize that care and make it more patient-friendly.
Alex Olgan is our health reporter here at WFAE. Dina DiOrio is also with us. She's the county manager for Mecklenburg County. We're talking about the recent consultant recommendations to improve care and the structure of the health department. We'll continue our conversation in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNCC College of Arts and Architecture, presenting Everything is Everything, a five-decade retrospective of T.J. Reddy's paintings and words, Thursday, July 20th at the Center City Gallery. Details at arts.uncc.edu. Well, on the local news roundup tomorrow, a recommendation for change at the Mecklenburg County Health Department and a steep price tag to go along. We'll delve into that a little bit more tomorrow with our roundtable of reporters. Major League Soccer reps head to town in advance of the city council vote on whether to support a local bid for a franchise. Major League Baseball now says Charlotte is a possibility for an expansion team. And Congresswoman Alma Adams holds a town hall on health care. We look at those stories Boys and several others tomorrow when our roundtable of reporters gathers for the local news roundup right here on Charlotte Talks at 9.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on the next On Point, a ProPublica and New York Times investigation of President Trump's regulatory rollbacks raises red flags. We'll dig in. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That's from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Alex Olgan is here from our WFAE newsroom. She's our health reporter. Dina DiIorio is the Mecklenburg County Manager. And we are talking about the recent release of reports from two consultants on how to improve the services and the quality of care at the Mecklenburg County Health Department, which has had a little snafu in operations over the last year. Consultants from Navigant, which is one of the companies you hired, Dina, to analyze all this, assured the county commission this week that the problems at the health department are fixable. They made six priority suggestions for change. They suggested one of the things that you mentioned, enhancing electronic medical records to help clinic performance and to eliminate multiple documentation approaches, which minimize patient risk. They suggest restructuring the current clinical care model and delivery systems, redesigning the consumer or the customer contact and call center to maximize centralization. We'll talk about all this. And standardization, pursuing a strategic laboratory management affiliation with an external partner for in-house lab operations, all among other things. I'm told that you jumped on the electronic records portion of this, along with partnering with outside lab management. First of all, talk about those things and why are they so important to you?
Well, the electronic medical record is really the foundation for everything that you do in any kind of medical practice. I mean, I think everybody knows now how important an electronic medical record is. It contains all the information about your medical history and your visits. And so what we have a situation is that we're not using the medical record system we have effectively, and people are scanning documents in, and it's just not – it's not doing what we need it to do. And so we have an opportunity to either upgrade the version that we have or move to a new platform. I think if we do that, it'll create a tremendous amount of efficiencies.
But also, weren't people late in putting entries into the medical records, so they weren't there even though they were – the information was there. They just weren't in the records.
Poor training. Very poor training. And so that would be another thing that we need to look at is how people are getting trained, make sure they get retrained on a periodic basis so that we know and set out the expectation about how you use the medical record and the expectation that you must use the medical record. So I think there's a few things related to that.
Alex.
And one thing that the consultant mentioned was something like 80% of the work was done on paper, and he called the electronic medical record system like an electronic filing cabinet where they were just putting all this data, but it wasn't really well organized. And another thing that the consulting firm mentioned was it would be beneficial to have compatible systems with the two hospitals here, Novant and Carolina's healthcare system, so that if the patient goes to different places, you know, you can pull up the electronic medical record.
Does Carolina's healthcare system and Novant, do they have complementary systems? Can they speak to each other electronically?
I don't know if they speak to each other.
I mean, if they want to, are the records in a compatible format?
Well, they actually, a couple weeks ago, just said that they're going to start sharing records.
Okay.
So I don't know if that means they have the same system, but they will be sharing records.
What about this outside – this partnering with outside labs? What is that all about?
So, you know, we do a lot of lab tests in our lab, and there are some labs that are time sensitive where we need to know the results before the patient leaves. And then there are other labs that can be sent out and that are not as time sensitive. And so – What this really means is that the labs that are not time sensitive, we should be sending out to a private lab to do, and that we should really just do in-house the things that are time sensitive. And that will make that a lot more efficient for us and also help us with the management of the lab. The lab director position has been vacant for a very long time, and we are unable to fill that. So we need to really look at how we manage our lab.
You've talked about the outdated technology in use at the health department. Is that strictly on the electronic records portion of this, or are there other pieces of outdated technology that should be replaced?
Well, that's the primary one. We also work with a lot of other state systems, and we have to make sure that data gets into some of the state systems, which clearly we don't have any control over, but we need to make sure our EMR system is as robust as it needs to be.
Alex, you report that Commissioner Pat Cotham had concerns about customer service. What were they?
she actually told me that she went to some of the clinics and tried to observe what was going on. And she said that she felt like patients were just being shuffled around and that the people at the clinics were not as focused at helping that individual patient get the care they need. Just like, well, I can't help you, so go here, that kind of thing. And she felt like she wanted to see a more patient-centered attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And she just told me that she just wants those patients to feel like they're important.
And was that addressed in the reports?
It was. I think one of the recommendations is to centralize that patient registration process for when you make an appointment and when you're going to come into the clinic. And I think Commissioner Cottom is exactly right. I mean, we want our patients to feel the same way as they would feel as if they went to any other doctor's mm-hmm. office. And so we need to make sure that we model best-in-class behavior for our patients.
Well, before the break, we talked about the patient access to things wasn't very straightforward, that you had to call multiple phone numbers to get help. You had to go to multiple different locations to get that help. Are those, obviously, that's inefficient for everybody. Is that something that's easy to fix, or will that cause a major reorganization of things?
I don't know that it'll cause a major reorganization, but it will require a reorganization that will allow patients to access clinics differently so that you can go to any clinic and get serviced as where it is now, that there's certain kinds of tests that are and services that are provided at each specific clinic. So what the recommendation is to have a more patient-centered clinical structure.
So as all of this information trickled out about the problems that have been going on for evidently a long time at the health department, and as these reports became available to you, have you come to any conclusion about what the root cause of all this may be?
Well, I think it's really hard to say. I think, we've only really been in the business since 2013. Again, we took it back from Carolina's Healthcare that had it for 20 years. And so I think we really didn't know what we were taking back. And I think for me, the lessons learned is that when we took it back, again, there should have been a lot more due diligence on what we inherited when we took it back and tried to address the issues then. And that is not what happened.
What the consultant found was there were culture problems, that the health department was reactive instead of proactive, and that managers weren't really listening to their employees, didn't have a pulse of what was going on. And they were in so many meetings that a lot of times they weren't in the clinic to sort of supervise. They said specifically about the director of nursing that she instilled fear within the clinical staff, and like there was a barrier between her and the staff – or him. I'm not sure who that
right.
specific person is.
When Jim Puckett was on – Commissioner Jim Puckett was on this program last week, he called this a massively poor management. Was it the clash of objectives, do you think? Because I've been told and I've read that Marcus Plesha had one idea, had one particular vision of what he wanted the health department to be and what its purpose was. And he was very concerned about preventive health measures versus necessarily providing the day-to-day care that a lot of these people require and they can only get from the health department. So was it that? Was it a clash of cultures within the agency with people not liking the direction it was going, so they were going to put up roadblocks of their own to prevent it from going in that direction? Was it the result of bad attitudes on the part of a few employees? What conclusion did you reach?
Well, I think it's a combination of all those things. I think, one of the things that I really want people to understand is that, the vast majority of the employees in the health department are incredibly passionate and compassionate and really committed to the work that they do. Mm-hmm. So I don't want people to come away thinking that, the employees don't care about providing good care, because that is not the case. I do think that Dr. Plesha had a specific vision for where he wanted the health department to go. And I think that was part of what he was working on. But again, you have to manage the entire department. And so, that's something when we look for the next health director, we need to look for somebody who's got the skills to manage the entire breadth of the work that we do there.
He left. He resigned on his own, I'm sure. I'm sure there was some pressure for him to resign, but he resigned on his own, and he takes issue with a lot of this.
I'm sure he does. And if certainly he's entitled to his opinion. I think the facts speak for themselves. I think the consultant reports and the findings and the recommendations are spot on. And so now, our focus is to move forward. And, we've always, focused on being transparent about the work that we do. And right now our focus is going to be on going through those reports, analyzing those recommendations, and putting together a plan to implement them and to move forward to create a best-in-class public health department for this community.
Which some have said will take more than a year to implement some of these changes. And you've said that things could get a lot worse before they get better. Why?
I think it will get worse before it gets better, because when you talk about restructuring, a lot of employees, you know, get nervous around change. They don't like change. Although they want change for the better, sometimes change can be adverse for them specifically. So we anticipate that it'll be hard for employees, especially those who have been working for us for a long time. So we will be going out and engaging a group to help us with change management, to really work with our employees, to help them understand why we're doing the change and helping them to embrace the change, because we need them to be supportive and we need them to buy in. Otherwise, the change isn't going to be successful.
There was some controversy over the person chosen to be the interim health director, Alma Gibby Harris, because she was one of the partners in Praxis Partners for Health, one of the consultants that you hired. But she was also the health director of the year in North Carolina when she was in Buncombe County. One would presume that because she was with Praxis Partners and they did the analysis, that at least she, as the interim health director, is on the same page with the plan going forward. Is that, would you say that's true?
I would say that's true, and I think people need to recognize that what we asked Praxis Partners to do was really look at organizational structure. So we did not feel hiring her as the interim health director created any kind of conflict. And as you said, she is a very, very skilled public health director in North Carolina, and we are incredibly fortunate that she has agreed to step in and be our interim health director.
What about the cost? The number that I heard was $1.5 million. That, you know, to an average person, that sounds like a fortune, but to a county whose budget is in the billions, it's not a lot of money. Is that a lot of money?
Oh, I think it's a lot of money, and I think that's what we're going to be doing, is looking at the implementation plan that we got from Navigant and what they will charge us to help us with the implementation plan, and really try to understand, what parts of that we need to go forward with, and you know how much we should really spend on that.
Where that money's going to? Is to the consultants, or is it going to other things?
No, it's going to the consultants to help us implement the recommendations, and so we need to make sure that that's going to be money well spent. So we're going to take a close look at that. In addition to that, any changes we need to make to the electronic medical record. Mm-hmm. Now, Navigant has quoted us a cost of $3 million. We need to take a really close look at that to see if that's something that we really need to do. So, yes.
One of the other county commissioners, George Dunlop, has expressed the thought that it might be better to have clinicians and health experts serving as the Board of Health. The Board of Health in Mecklenburg County, unusually speaking, is the county commission. It seems odd to me that they're the Board of Health. Any thought about making that transition?
I know that's something that the board is interested in talking about. The Board of County Commissioners has served as the Board of Health for decades, and so we've never had really an outside Board of Health for a very, very long time. But it's something that they're interested in looking at. I think there's pros and cons to that structure, and it's something we want to evaluate.
And you've also talked about being open to any and all possibilities going forward. And one of those possibilities is the privatization of the health department. What would that look like, and why is that even a possibility? That seems to be, an oxymoron.
Well, and you know, we just came from a almost privatized situation. We were with Carolina's healthcare system, which people believe was privatized, but in fact, Carolina's healthcare system is actually a government. So, but they are private. They are hospital systems, so they're not working within county government. The lab piece that we're talking about is a form of privatization. I don't know that actually giving it back to Carolina's healthcare is an option. I don't know that Novant would be interested in taking it on. And I just think that based on what we got back from Carolina's healthcare system, we need to be very careful about whether or not we think that's the right approach.
County Manager Dina DiOrio also with us. Alex Olgan, our health reporter here at WFAE News. Keep us posted.
I will.
And keep us posted on MLS soccer as well, okay?
I will. All thank right. you.
Thank you both for being here. Well, 100 years ago this month, actually this weekend, Camp Green began in Charlotte. It opened. Well, it didn't open, but it began to break ground in Charlotte 100 years ago this month. Its purpose was to train soldiers for World War I. Although estimates vary because of missing records, it is believed that between 40 and 60,000 men passed through the camp, which was located where Wilkinson Boulevard and Moorhead Streets intersect today. Although the camp itself is long gone, the centennial observance of Camp Green will take place this weekend, and here to fill us in on the camp's history and significance is World War I historian Dr. Heather Perry, Associate Professor of History at UNC Charlotte. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Leonard Bennett is also with us. He is the historian for the 4th Infantry Division, which was one of three units formed at Camp Green back in the 1917 era. Welcome to you.
Absolutely right, sir. Thank you.
NWFAE Morning Edition host Marshall Terry has been reporting on all this, and he, too, is with us. Good morning, Marshall.
Hey, Mike.
Your first time on this program.
It's my first
Where
time.
Where have you been?
All right. Right next door. Literally.
Charlotte natives may know about Camp Green in the backs of their minds, but a lot of people who are new to Charlotte are going, what? Never heard of it. Why did the Army open Camp Green in 1917, Lieutenant Colonel?
The Army typically would establish temporary camps, and they were called a camp. So,
and they were called camps for a specific reason,
they were
right?
temporary.
And they were living in tents?
Living in tents. They would take a location, a remote location generally outside the city, because, of course, you had problems with disease and sanitation when you bring this many people. Almost as many soldiers came in as lived in Charlotte. So they built these camps, these training camps outside. The tradition really started during the Civil War and even earlier.
But why Charlotte, Dr. Perry? How did we snag this?
Well, Charlotte sent a committee up to D.C. to lobby as the federal government was making their decisions about where to locate camps and really pushed the fact that Charlotte was an ideal location.
Because
of its access to water, because of the roadways and infrastructure, and because of the environment that they could offer.
And because they put a lot of these camps, because they were camps in the South where the weather was nice. Didn't turn out to be the case for Camp Green.
They expected the weather to be nice.
Didn't turn out to be the case here. We'll talk about that. We entered the war. The United States entered World War I in April of 1917. This camp was thrown up literally in 90 days. That is a remarkable feat. What was it like?
The soldiers first the engineers, the Army engineers come in, and they use some contract labor, and they built a camp and some infrastructure to build tent cities. So these soldiers came and they were housed in tents. These are mainly farm boys, people that live on farms, and they, of course, were required to register for selective service.
Mm-hmm.
They came before a draft board and they were ordered. Generally, logistically, the folks that would have come to Camp Green would have typically come from North or South Carolina. And logistically, it would make sense to bring them here. They would go through their basic training.
But wait. I understand that most of these people that came in here were from Massachusetts, the Midwest, and the Pacific Northwest. Is that right? And the guys from North Carolina went to South Carolina.
Ultimately. So the initial ones, guys who are coming from Sevier and Jackson. And that's part of those soldiers, along with local Charlottians, are hired to help create and construct the camp. But eventually, as the U.S. realizes that it has to really build up a huge military force that's going to, in order to fight this war, they end up bringing soldiers from other areas.
That's basically what I was going to say, too. Yeah, they had to bring – and also because the weather, less hospital, presumably in the northeast or the northwest, get them down to the south where it's easier to train all year. Again, that didn't happen necessarily in Charlotte. Also, something interesting that I found from a historian I spoke to with the state, she said that Camp Green initially at the very beginning was a National Guard camp, but then it quickly switched over to being an Army camp, and that's a reason – why a lot of soldiers in North Carolina ended up going to places like South Carolina where there were – because they were National Guard troops and they trained down there.
And the reason these camps were thrown up so quickly, and I think there were 32 or 52 of them around the country, was because we had no standing army at that time. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment. We have to take a break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord, offering a summer selection of vehicles, new and used. Details at Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord at the Hendrick Auto Mall Concord Mills or HendrickVW of Concord.com. And the Jazz Arts Initiative presenting trumpeter Corey Wilkes for a tribute to jazz trumpeter Freddie Hubbard, July 21st and 22nd, part of the monthly Jazz Room series at the Blumenthal Stage Door Theater. Tickets available at BlumenthalArts.org. A ProPublica and New York Times investigation of President Trump's regulatory rollbacks raises red flags. They will dig into that in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock during On Point. If you happen to miss our public conversation on the rising homicide count in Charlotte on Tuesday night or Wednesday morning, you can hear the entire program on our website, get some interesting links to go elsewhere, and to participate in an ongoing part of the conversation. You can do that all at WFAE.org.
All Things Considered on WFAE helps you go beneath the surface of the day's news.
What he pointed me to was a clause in CMPD's use of force guidelines, which says officers should only use deadly force when the suspect is engaged in aggravated active aggression that can lead to the death.
There's more to every story. Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 for All Things Considered from NPR News and 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Heather Perry is an historian at UNC Charlotte and an expert on World War I. Lieutenant Colonel Leonard Bennett is the historian for the 4th Infantry Division of the U.S. Army, retired, I believe. But no, you're not retired. You're still there. But anyway, he knows all about Camp Green, which is one of the where the 4th Infantry Division was established back in 1917. And Marshall Terry is here, host of Morning Edition for WFAE, because he's been reporting on this. Because most people in Charlotte, Marshall, don't know where this is, and I mentioned that it was at where the intersection of Moorhead Street and Wilkinson Boulevard is. That's just where it started. Give us the lay of the land. How big was it? How much of the land did it take up?
Originally, 2,600 acres, but almost from the beginning, they were expanding, and it stayed pretty much in a state of expansion for a year, year and a half, until they closed it, until they started taking it down. And to give you a sense of where in Charlotte exactly, that intersection you mentioned is correct. Just think of it being between Wilkinson Boulevard and Tuckasegee Road. If you look at a map, that was pretty much where it was.
But it was big enough for them to dig five miles of trenches to, I guess, practice for what they'd have to do in the First World War, which was trench warfare back then. That's a lot of land.
It is a lot of land. And again, they expanded it almost immediately. By the fall, they added a rifle and pistol range. That was over by the Catawba River to the west. And then also there was an artillery range over near where Kings Mountain is.
And an airstrip.
I've been told an airfield over there near where the old Freedom Mall, that's before my time. I don't know exactly where that is, but I'm sure some people do. Yeah. But apparently there was an airfield there. And just going back to the pistol range and the artillery range, they forced them to march those distances to train them for all the marching they were going to be doing in Europe.
We'll talk about that. Well, as soon as this was, as the need for the camp was over, when the war ended, because the war ended shortly after we got into it, they dismantled the camp. Mm-hmm. Are there any landmarks that still exist today?
I think the biggest one is the Doubt House.
Of course. And the county's done such a wonderful job preserving this and supporting that. The Doubt House was the original farmhouse, and it still survives. And they have several artifacts over there.
And it was set up as the headquarters of the camp, certainly donated by the family, the Dowd family, still here in Charlotte. And last year, Parks and Rec and the Historic Landmark Commission worked together to rebuild and refurbish that and get it ready for the commemoration next weekend.
I said in the beginning that the exact number of recruits who went through the camp has been lost to history. It seems to be a little misty. I've read figures from, I think, 30 to 60,000 people. Why don't we know precisely? The Army keeps good records. Why don't we know precisely? And do you have any idea what the real figure might be, either of you?
Well, historians typically say a total of 60,000, but of course men are coming and going all of the time. So probably at any one point, 30 to 35,000. Part of the issue is that initially the Army was supposed to house them 5 to a tent, but they were cramming them in at one point up to 8 to a tent, which contributed not just to overcrowding, but
sanitary
problems.
We have to remember also the size of Charlotte back then in 1917, and I've read different figures about that. And maybe that's because those figures get confused between the size of Charlotte and the size of Mecklenburg County and the towns surrounding Mecklenburg County. But when these guys were there, Marshall, I get the impression that it doubled or tripled the size of Charlotte.
Something like that. Now, I was going off the 1910 census numbers. Uh-huh. That places Charlotte at about 34,000.
Okay.
Of course, this is several years after the 1910 census, but it jumps up to, I think, 46,000 in 1920. You know, a lot of people say, well, that's because the camp was here. Probably had something to do with it. But yeah, that's the number. That's where I got my numbers from.
So how did this impact Charlotte? You're doubling, tripling the population with all these 19 and 18 and 17 and 20-year-old guys. What did that do to Charlotte?
Well, it was a huge economic boom for the city.
Which is why we tried to get it here, right?
Definitely one of the reasons, for sure. you know, suddenly you have all of these soldiers who are have some disposable income. And we have a lot of Charlotte businesses, Belk Department Store, for instance, that are catering to them and soliciting them and trying to provide articles of clothing or shoes, coats. It also really fostered a whole kind of entertainment sector or industry as city officials and civic organizations planned dances and teas and opened up their doors and built soldiers' clubs as ways to entertain the soldiers, but also to create safe ways for soldiers and locals to interact that could be monitored and supervised.
The Charlotte Observer, I'm told, published a special newspaper for them every week.
Trench and Camp.
Trench and Camp?
Yes.
Which was full of things that only they would understand, right? but they also published in their regular editions things to help citizens understand all these insignias that they were seeing walking around town and what the various military designations meant. And I also read that Charlotte was a very different town in 1917, that a lot of Army commanders refused to allow their soldiers to eat in the restaurants in Charlotte because they didn't think they were deplorable. They thought they were deplorable. The conditions were deplorable. And that led the restaurateurs to improve things, right?
This is news to me, Mike. Thanks for the information.
You're welcome.
I do know that they were rapidly improving sanitation and building restrooms. And there was a big scandal about the cafeterias here and who would run the cafeterias. So this may be feeding into that.
A number of experts have cited the arrival of Camp Green as the start of modern-day Charlotte. Tom Hanchett, who is the retired historian at the Levine Museum of the New South, says that Camp Green was the moment the outside world took notice of this little place. It helped Charlotte dream big. You agree with that?
I do. It not only gave Charlottians a sense of what it's like to interact with outsiders, particularly outsiders from the South, but it also created an opportunity for these young men to experience the South. And they're writing letters to their families, letters to their girlfriends, letters to their wives. And those family members are coming from Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Massachusetts. And they're coming down here to Charlotte to visit their brothers and sons and husbands who are in the Army. So it's just creating a huge kind of hospitality industry and gave Charlottians the confidence that they could handle that kind of tourism and visitation.
The 4th Division was established here, one of the three divisions organized at Camp Green in December, I believe, of 1917, under the command of Major General George H. Cameron. The 4th Division is now based in Fort Carson, Colorado. What has been their contribution to the military and to the U.S. Army over 2 years?
The 3rd Infantry, as you said, was established here, and my unit, the 4th Infantry Division as well. These were regular Army units prior to 1917. They brought up militia, or what we would call it, the National Guard. It was renamed the National Guard around this time. And they started using regular Army units for these type of operations. The 4th Infantry started here and had a huge contribution in World War I. 3rd Infantry left first, and they went by steamship to Europe to participate in the war, followed by 4th Infantry after that. And our commander of 4th ID was General Cameron. He took the division forward. And, of course, the English and the French have been fighting the Germans in World War I for quite some time, since 1914. And there were not a lot of dramatic successes, but General Cameron was able to take the 4th ID and achieve success in his first operation. In fact, he was promoted to be the commander of the 5th Corps later. Mm-hmm. But then later there was a small controversy with General Pershing's chief of staff, and Cameron was fired and went back to 4th Infantry Division. It was basically General Pershing had left the area, and the chief of staff of the Army Expeditionary Force had assumed command of the Army. Mm-hmm. And what happened is there was the colonel, who was the chief of staff, called this two-star general and said, "You did not achieve your objective," and berated him. And Cameron did not take it well and told him he would have him fired. And later, Pershing fired Cameron. But Cameron was a great general. And our division today is all over the world. We have a forward deployed headquarters. Right. We've participated in every
In World War II, you were on the beaches in Normandy.
We actually were at Utah Beach.
Okay.
General Roosevelt, who was President Theodore Roosevelt's son, was in command. He received the Medal of Honor. We landed at Utah Beach, and it was the 4th Infantry Division in World War II that captured Paris.
Oh.
And we had some famous folks. David Thomas was, not in World War II, but afterwards, was a cook in the 4th Infantry Division, the guy that created Wendy's.
Wendy's, Dave Thomas.
Yep, that's right. our most famous... we had a correspondent that was assigned in World War II, Ernest Hemingway, said that his favorite division, his three favorite things were a Caribbean woman that he loved and the 4th Infantry Division. And he loved the division because he was there when they captured Paris.
How many people in an infantry division?
Interestingly enough, today we have 16 to 20,000, including support soldiers. In World War I, again, they're trying to maximize firepower.
Right.
Today we have 4 brigades. Then they had 8 brigades. These divisions were huge organizations, 20,000, 25,000 troops. And the idea was to have a large force that you could impact on the enemy. And, so the third and fourth idea were very similar in their composition.
So Camp Green didn't last all that long, but it was established in July of 1917. And in fact, I guess it broke ground on what would be this coming Monday, the 17th of July in 1917. You spoke, Marshall, with Jack Dillard, who made a documentary on this camp a few years back. And he mentioned that there were problems at the camp almost from the very beginning. What kind of problems are we talking about?
The biggest, I think, was the weather. Again, the reason that the military wanted to put these in the south, as we mentioned, is because it's always warm here, right? It's mild. You can stay outside all year long. That turned out not to be the case. Initially, or the first thing that happened in the fall was there was a lot of rain. And they had just cleared all this land. It was red clay mud. That it becomes even muddier when it's 3 or 4 days straight of rain. That really hampered training. You couldn't get supplies in and out. That really was an impediment. But then that winter, which we've talked about, it's one of the worst on record. Snow, ice, a couple blizzards. There's a couple pictures that you can see online at WFA.org, actually. One is a picture in the camp in between a row of tents, and it says, probably derisively at the top, the sunny south. And it's just caked in snow. The weather was the biggest problems, from what I understand.
And then in 1918, there was the massive influenza epidemic that was all over the world, actually, and it killed millions of people, or at least hundreds of thousands of people. It took 300 to 400 men's lives at Camp Green. Why? How did it reach Charlotte? Do we know?
So ultimately, historians, of course, argue, but some 30 to 50 million died in the Spanish epidemic. Flu. And we think it starts off in Kansas, probably Camp Funston, and gradually spreads. It follows the soldiers. And so as soldiers are moved from one camp to another, the flu sort of spread with them. From what we know about North Carolina's experience, it probably was in Wilmington first and gradually spread westward.
There were 14,000 African-American troops at Camp Green. How unusual was that for that time, 100 years ago?
Very. In fact, when the camp was first built, they were told and expected no African-American soldiers to be stationed there. It was very much a surprise when those logistics changed by about the middle of 1918.
Mm-hmm.
But it's worth remembering that Americans were not sure how many men they would have to send overseas, and they weren't sure how many soldiers were needed. So as they continue mustering up and passing the selective service law in order to draft men, they begin bringing in African-American soldiers.
In your reporting on this, Marshall, you point out that beginning again in about the year 2000, the area where Camp Green was began to call itself the Camp Green Neighborhood Association.
That's right.
Why?
That's what they told me. There was just a group of I don't think anybody in the Neighborhood Association now was there then, but they told me just a group of residents kind of broke off from, I think it's Ashley Park is the neighborhood over there, and wanted to do their own thing. And through this piece of history that exists literally where they're sleeping and where they walk up and down the street. They decided to call themselves the Camp Green Neighborhood Association. And around that time, a map from the city of Charlotte, they talked with the city, I guess, and it ended up being identified as the Camp Green neighborhood.
As soon as the war ended, they disassembled this camp. I mean, they started, and all the lumber went to scrap. The horses and the mules were sold, all to defray the costs of the war. There were 32 of these camps established around the country for training purposes. Was that the fate of all of them?
Some of the camps were determined. They determined that there might be a need for a larger regular army force. So some of the camps, Camp Jackson.
Became
Fort Jackson. Camp Carson, well, was established in World War II. But the War Department at the time determined which ones would become permanent installations.
So go ahead.
I would say it's interesting to go back and read the congressional records and hearings at the time while as they're discussing in early 1919 which ones to close and which ones to keep open, and they're trying to kind of predict the future, as of course one can. And some of the things that come up are that Camp Green's mud and clay problem. And then they sort of referenced the easier to navigate sandy soil over by Camp Bragg.
I was going
to
say Camp Bragg is another one that came online around this time, right at the end of the war. But a couple of years later, it becomes Fort Bragg.
So. Right.
So this put Charlotte on the map. It brought newcomers to town, many of whom came back after the war was over because they liked what they saw. That swelled the population of the city a bit. It brought electricity and other infrastructure projects to that side of town that have lasted to this day. And the Camp Green Neighborhood Association is having a centennial celebration this weekend that I guess people are invited to. And you can find out more information about that at historiccampgreen.com. And Green is after Nathaniel Green, the Revolutionary War hero, and his name is spelled with three E's.
Yes.
G-R-E-E-N-E. There you go. Marshal Terry from WFAE News, Dr. Heather Perry with UNC Charlotte, Lieutenant Colonel Leonard Bennett from the 4th Infantry Division, U.S. Army. Thanks for